This is Audible.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Penguin Random House Audio presents Star Wars Battlefront, Twilight Company by Alexander Freed. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. The Galactic Empire endures, despite the destruction of its terrifying Death Star by the Rebel Alliance. Its oppression spreads undiminished across the stars. Under the direction of the Emperor and Darth Vader, an army of highly trained, single-minded stormtroopers quashes dissent and destroys resistance. But on worlds like Sullust, Coyerte, Hadoral Prime, and untold others, Rebel forces fight in the trenches, determined to maintain hope against the unrelenting Imperial war machine. Part 1. Withdrawal. Chapter 1.
Planet Crucible. Day 47 of the Malkani Insurrections. 13 years after the Clone Wars.
His name was Donan. And though that wasn't the name he'd been born with, he had the ink-rubbed brands to prove it. The black whorls and waves freshly applied by the clan masters in honor of his induction ran across his dusky shoulder blades under his coarse cloth jacket. They were one of four gifts he'd received upon joining the army of the warlord Malkan. A new name, the brands, a serrated knife, and an off-worlder's particle blaster. The masters had assured him that of the four gifts, the blaster was the most precious. Its grip was wrapped in fraying leather, and its barrel was scored and crusted with ash. It had enough power left to fire a dozen searing bolts, and Donan had been warned not to waste a single shot or drop it if it began to burn his palms. Those were the acts of a child, not a full member of the clan. He knelt among his new brothers and sisters. He'd yet to learn their names, behind a low stone wall that stretched across the hilltop. His slight frame, thin from youth and hunger, allowed him to conceal himself fully behind the barricade. For this reason, he had been assigned to the front. Like his brands and weapons, that assignment was a privilege. He reminded himself as much when he began to sweat and tremble. He glanced sidelong at his companions and looked for signs that they too were afraid of the coming battle. They were nearly all larger and older, carrying off-world weapons that appeared as scored and rusted as his own. They cleaned their knives and murmured to one another. Donan told himself he would die for them, as they would die for him, in the name of the clan and its warlord. And if they won the day, if I survived the battle, Donan corrected himself. Victory was inevitable for the warlord Malkan. Only Donan's own fate was in question. Then they would celebrate. He'd heard stories of feasts, of troughs of clear water and skewers of bantha meat, of salts and sauces from other continents, other planets. He would gorge himself, he thought, and sleep in safety in the warlord's camp. He'd heard the clan celebrations before, while hiding, shivering in his father's home, and those joyful cries were what had finally lured him to the masters. His father had said the Malkanis were no different than any other faction on Crucible, but his father was wrong. No one else had such food or took so much joy in victory. No one else was as strong as Malkan, or had the wisdom to procure such a trove of off-world technology. Donan's new clan would build a better planet. Something far away howled in the dusty air, starting soft and rising rapidly. Donan squared his shoulders, half stood from his crouch, and thrust his blaster over the wall in one movement, as he'd been taught. He saw no target. A man's voice laughed behind him, and a broad palm cupped his dark hair and tilted his head back.
"Battle ain't started yet, boy. Just a ship headed to the tower. Get us all killed if you shoot."
His gaze redirected, Donan saw the sphere and crossbars of an off-world flyer silhouetted against the clouds. It roared in the direction of the steel spire and faded from view. Donan lowered himself to his knees again, and the hand on his head disappeared. He'd made a fool of himself. He silently pledged not to do it again. "We didn't see them much in the gulches," he murmured. An explanation, not an excuse.
The man behind him grunted. "You'll see them a lot here. I'm serious about not shooting. Don't go within a stone's throw of the tower either, no matter what happens. The off-worlders in white may not come out much, but you bother them even a little."
"I know," Donan snapped. He swiveled and looked up at the man, who could have been four times Donan's age, with milky eyes and pitted skin. Older than the warlord himself. But that didn't mean he'd been part of the clan any longer than Donan. "I know all about them. Their soldiers are clones. They make them in batches."
The man grunted again, showing cracked yellow teeth and something that might have been a smile. "You don't say. Who told you that?"
"My father," Donan said. "He used to fight them." He gestured with his head toward the sky, toward the stars hidden behind yellow-gray clouds. "There was a war."
"Well, you're not fighting clones," the man said. "You're fighting the lowlifes who took the quarry last week and want our territory. That exciting enough for you?"
Donan scowled and stared. "I'm here to serve the clan," he said, and pivoted back to face the wall. One hand still clasping his blaster, he reached with the other to jerk down the collar of his jacket, displaying his brands to the man behind him. Donan heard the man laugh, felt a slap on his spine that rocked him forward.
"I guess you are," the man said. "Just don't get your hopes up. Take it one fight at a time."
Donan nodded, shrugged his jacket higher on his back, and gripped his blaster tighter. He wasn't sure what the man meant. The clan was hope for them all. It wasn't long before someone yelled that the enemy was approaching. The front line pressed against the wall and peered over. Donan saw specks against the brittle yellow grass in the valley below the hill. And soon, those specks resolved into the shapes of dozens of men and women. Most held spears above their heads like pennants. Only a few carried off-world weapons. But those weapons were the size of tree branches, cradled by their owners in both arms. The first of those weapons ignited with reverberating screams. Streaks of green fire spewed over the wall. The warlord's army became a mass of shouts Donan didn't understand. He steadied his blaster, reminded himself not to waste shots.
"All praise to the warlord!"
someone called, and the shouting became a cheer. A rush of warmth filled the boy as he grinned and added his voice to the hurrah. His name was Donan now. He was defending his new home. These were his brothers and sisters. Their path was righteous, and he'd be part of their clan forever.
Chapter 2. Planet Hadoral Prime. Day 84 of the Midrim Retreat. 9 years later.
The rain on Hadoral Prime dropped in warm sheets from a shining sky. It smelled like vinegar, clung to the molded curves of modular industrial buildings and to litter-strewn streets, and coated skin like a sheen of acrid sweat. After 30 standard hours, it was losing its novelty for the soldiers of Twilight Company. Three figures crept along a deserted avenue under a torn and dripping canopy. The lean, compact man in the lead was dressed in faded gray fatigues and a hodgepodge of armor pads, crudely stenciled with the starboard symbol of the Rebel Alliance. Matted dark hair dripped beneath his visored helmet, sending crawling trails of rainwater down his bronze face. His name was Hazram Namir, though he'd gone by others. He silently cursed urban warfare and Hadoral Prime and whichever laws of atmospheric science made it rain. The thought of sleep flashed into his mind and broke against a wall of stubbornness. He gestured with a rifle thicker than his arm toward the nearest intersection, then quickened his pace. Somewhere in the distance, a swift series of blaster shots resounded, followed by shouts and silence. The figure closest behind Namir, a tall man with graying hair and a face puckered with scar tissue, bounded across the street to take up a position opposite. The third figure, a massive form huddled in a tarp like a hooded cloak, remained behind. The scarred man flashed a hand signal. Namir turned the corner onto the intersecting street. A dozen meters away, the sodden lumps of human bodies lay in the road. They wore tattered rain gear, sleek, lightweight wraps and sandals, and carried no weapons. Non-combatants. It's a shame, Namir thought, but not a bad sign. The Empire didn't shoot civilians when everything was under control. Charmer, take a look. Namir indicated the bodies. The scarred man strode over as Namir tapped his comlink. Sector secure, he said. What's on tap next? The response came in a hiss of static through Namir's earpiece, something about mop-up operations. Namir missed having a communications specialist on staff. Twilight Company's last comm tech had been a drunk and a misanthrope, but she'd been magic with the transmitter, and she'd written obscene poetry with Namir on late, dull nights. She and her idiot droid had died in the bombardment on a surface. Say again, Namir tried. Are we ready to load? This time the answer came through clearly.
Support teams are crating up food and equipment. If you've got a lead on medical supplies, we'd love more for the Thunderstrike. Otherwise, get to the rendezvous. We only have a few hours before reinforcements show.
Tell support to grab hygiene items this time, Namir said. Anyone who says they're luxuries needs to smell the barracks. There was another burst of static and maybe a laugh.
I'll let them know. Stay safe.
Charmer was finishing his study of the bodies, checking each for a heartbeat and identification. He shook his head, silent as he straightened.
Atrocity.
The hulking figure wrapped in the tarp had finally approached. His voice was deep and resonant. Two meaty, four-fingered hands kept the tarp clasped at his shoulders, while a second pair of hands loosely carried a massive blaster cannon at waist level.
How can anyone born of flesh do this?
Charmer bit his lip. Namir shrugged. Could have been combat droids for all we know.
Unlikely,
the hulking figure said.
But if so, responsibility belongs to the governor.
He knelt beside one of the corpses and reached out to lid its eyes. Each of his hands was as large as the dead man's head. Come on, Gadrin. Namir said, someone will find them. Gadrin stayed kneeling. Charmer opened his mouth to speak, then shut it. Namir wondered whether to push the point, and if so, how hard. Then the wall next to him exploded, and he stopped worrying about Gadrin. Fire and metal shards and grease and insulation pelted his spine. He couldn't hear and couldn't guess how he ended up in the middle of the road among the bodies, one leg bent beneath him. Something tacky was stuck to his chin, and his helmet's visor was cracked. He had enough presence of mind to feel lucky he hadn't lost an eye. Suddenly, he was moving again. He was upright, and hands, Charmer's hands, were dragging him backward, clasping him below the shoulders. He snarled the native curses of his homeworld as a red storm of particle bolts flashed among the fire and debris. By the time he'd pushed Charmer away and wobbled onto his feet, he'd traced the bolts to their source. Four Imperial stormtroopers stood at the mouth of an alley up the street. Their deathly pale armor gleamed in the rain, and the black eyepieces of their helmets gaped like pits. Their weapons shone with oil and machined care, as if the squad had stepped fully formed out of a mold. Namir tore his gaze from the enemy long enough to see that his back was to a storefront window filled with video screens. He raised his blaster rifle, fired at the display, then climbed in among the shards. Charmer followed. The storefront wouldn't give them cover for long, certainly not if the stormtroopers fired another rocket, but it would have to be enough.
Check for a way up top!
Namir yelled, and his voice sounded faint and tinny. He couldn't hear the storm of blaster bolts at all.
We need covering fire!
Not looking to see if Charmer obeyed, he dropped to the floor as the stormtroopers adjusted their aim to the store. He couldn't spot Gadrin either. He ordered the alien into position anyway, hoping he was alive and that the comlink still worked. He lined his rifle under his chin, fired twice in the direction of the stormtroopers, and was rewarded with a moment of peace.
I need you on target, Brand, he growled into his link. I need you here now.
If anyone answered, he couldn't hear it. Now he glimpsed the stormtrooper carrying the missile launcher. The trooper was still reloading, which meant Namir had half a minute at most before the storefront came tumbling down on top of him. He took a few quick shots and saw one of the other troopers fall, though he doubted he'd hit his target. He guessed Charmer had found a vantage point after all. Three stormtroopers remaining. One was moving away from the alley while the other stayed to protect the artilleryman. Namir shot wildly at the one moving into the street, watched him skid and fall to a knee, and smiled grimly. There was something satisfying about seeing a trained stormtrooper humiliate himself. Namir's own side did it often enough. Jerky movements drew Namir's attention back to the artilleryman. Behind the stormtrooper stood Gadrin, both sets of arms gripping and lifting his foe. Human limbs flailed, and the missile launcher fell to the ground. White armor seemed to crumple in the alien's hands. Gadrin's makeshift hood blew back, exposing his head. A brown, bulbous, wide-mouthed mass topped with a darker crest of bone, like some amphibian's nightmare idol. The second trooper in the alley turned to face Gadrin and was promptly slammed to the ground with his comrade's body before Gadrin crushed them both, howling in rage or grief. Namir trusted Gadrin as much as he trusted anyone, but there were times when the alien terrified him. The last stormtrooper was still down on the street. Namir fired until flames licked a burnt and melted hole in the man's armor. Namir, Charmer, and Gadrin gathered back around the bodies and assessed their own injuries. Namir's hearing was coming back. The damage to his helmet extended far beyond the visor. A crack ran along its length, and he found a shallow cut across his forehead when he tossed the helmet to the street. Charmer was picking shards of shrapnel from his vest, but made no complaints. Gadrin was shivering in the warm rain.
No Brand?
Gadrin asked. Namir only grunted. Charmer laughed his weird, hiccuping laugh and spoke. He swallowed the words twice, three, four times as he went, half stuttering as he had ever since the fight on Black Tar Cyst.
Keep piling bodies like this, he said. We'll have the best vantage point in the city.
He gestured at Namir's last target, who had fallen directly onto one of the civilian corpses. You're a sick man, Charmer, Namir said, and swung an arm roughly around his comrade's shoulders. I'll miss you when they boot you out. Gadrin grunted and sniffed behind them. It might have been dismay, but Namir chose to take it as mirth. Officially, the city was Hadoral Administrative Center 1, but locals called it Glitter, after the crystalline mountains that limned the horizon. In Namir's experience, what the Galactic Empire didn't name to inspire terror, its stormtrooper legions, its star destroyer battleships, it tried to render as drab as possible. This didn't bother Namir, but he wasn't among the residents of the planets and cities being labeled. Half a dozen rebel squads had already arrived at the central plaza when Namir's team marched in. The rain had condensed into mist, and the plaza's tents and canopies offered little shelter. Nonetheless, men and women in ragged armor squeezed into the driest corners they could find, grumbling to one another or tending to minor wounds and damaged equipment. As victory celebrations went, it was subdued. It had been a long fight for little more than the promise of a few fresh meals.
"Stop admiring yourselves and do something useful!" Namir barked, barely breaking stride. "Support teams can use a hand if you're too good to play greeter."
He barely noticed the squad stir in response. Instead, his attention shifted to a woman emerging from the shadows of a speeder stand. She was tall and thickly built, dressed in rugged pants and a bulky maroon jacket. A scoped rifle was slung over her shoulder, and the armor mesh of a retracted face mask covered her neck and chin. Her skin was gently creased with age and as dark as a human's could be. Her hair cropped close to her scalp, but she didn't so much as glance at Namir as she arrived at his side and matched his pace through the plaza.
"You want to tell me where you were?"
Namir asked.
"You missed the second fire team. I took care of it," Bran said.
Namir kept his voice cool.
"Drop me a hint next time?"
"You didn't need the distraction."
Namir laughed.
"Love you too."
Brand cocked her head. If she got the joke, and Namir expected she did, she wasn't amused.
"So what now?"
she asked.
"We've got 8 hours before we leave the system," Namir said,
and stopped with his back to an overturned kiosk. He leaned against the metal frame and stared into the mist.
"Less if Imperial ships come before then, or if the Governor's forces regroup. After that, we'll divvy up the supplies with the rest of the battle group. Probably keep an escort ship or two for the Thunderstrike before the others split off."
"And we abandon this sector to the Empire," Bran said.
By this time, Charmer had wandered off and Gadrin had joined Namir and Bran.
"We will return,"
he said gravely.
"Right," Namir said, smirking.
"Something to look forward to." He knew they were the wrong words at the wrong time. 18 months earlier, the Rebel Alliance's 61st Mobile Infantry, commonly known as Twilight Company, had joined the push into the galactic mid-rim. The operation was among the largest the Rebellion had ever fielded against the Empire, involving thousands of starships, hundreds of battlegroups, and dozens of worlds. In the wake of the Rebellion's victory against the Empire's planet-burning Death Star battle station, High Command had believed the time was right to move from the fringes of Imperial territory toward its population centers. Twilight Company had fought in the factory deserts of Forsa Ged and taken the Ducal Palace of Bamayar. It had established beachheads for rebel hover tanks and erected bases from tarps and sheet metal. Namir had seen soldiers lose limbs and go weeks without proper treatment. He'd trained teams to construct makeshift bayonets when blaster power packs ran low. He'd set fire to cities and watched the Empire do the same. He'd left friends behind on broken worlds, knowing he'd never see them again. On planet after planet, Twilight had fought. Battles were won and battles were lost, and Namir stopped keeping score. Twilight remained at the Rebellion's vanguard, forging ahead of the bulk of the Armada, until word came down from High Command 9 months in. The fleet was overextended. There was to be no further advance, only defense of the newly claimed territories. Not long after that, the retreat began. Twilight Company had become the rear guard of a massive withdrawal. It deployed to worlds it had helped capture mere months earlier and evacuated the bases it had built. It extracted the Rebellion's heroes and generals and pointed the way home. It marched over the graves of its own dead soldiers. Some of the company lost hope. Some became angry. No one wanted to go back. When the civilians came out of hiding and into the plaza, the open recruit began. Sergeant Zab Squad, the squad Namir had once called in a moment of pique, morons who could make a Hydra spanner backfire, had somehow smuggled an astromech droid into the city surveillance center. From there, they'd accessed the public address system and broadcast the captain's message. Twilight Company would soon depart Hadoral Prime. Those on Hadoral who shared the rebellion's ideals of freedom and democracy could remain to defend their homes, or they could sign on with Twilight to take the fight to the enemy, to go where the rebellion was needed most, and so forth. The captain recorded a new broadcast every time Twilight went looking to bolster its ranks, tailored to the needs and the circumstances of the local population. To Namir, all the messages sounded alike. Open recruitments were technically against Rebel Alliance security policy, but they were a Twilight Company tradition, and the captain was insistent the practice continue. So long as the Rebellion sent Twilight into hell time and again, and so long as Twilight survived, the company would replenish its losses from the ranks of the willing. On Hadoral Prime, 7 Twilight soldiers had died. Namir hadn't yet seen their names. Twilight would need 7 newcomers to balance those losses, and still more to make up for those who died elsewhere in recent weeks. Dozens of men and women trickled into the plaza over the space of an hour, hand-checked by Twilight greeters for weapons and concealed explosives. Not all of them were there to be recruited. Barefoot women with calloused hands begged Twilight to stay. Hunched elderly men screamed for the company to leave. A disorganized band of locals voiced their desire to keep fighting the Empire on Hadoral. These were given what few weapons Twilight had to spare and sent away with meaningless well-wishing and invocations of the cause. The genuine recruits were a motley assortment of young and old, pampered and desperate. Namir paced among them, watched their eyes, and passed his assessments on to the recruiting officer. A bearded and bedraggled man had the look of a street person, but the carriage of a bureaucrat. Namir pegged him as an Imperial spy. A pug-nosed woman shifted her eyes to an escape route when Namir casually moved his weapon from one hand to the other. A petty criminal, looking for an easy way off the planet, he thought. That day's recruiting officer, Hober, a withered and creak-kneed quartermaster with a knack for card games, took Namir's recommendations with a shrug.
"You know Howell's orders," he said.
Namir did. Captain Ivan Howell went outside earshot, liked to err on the side of welcome. He and Namir had spoken at length about that particular policy. "Just keep an eye out," Namir said. "You have to be a special kind of crazy to jump aboard a sinking ship." Ober snorted and shook his head.
"Say that louder and we can close up early."
Namir didn't say it louder. A bit of crazy wasn't always a bad thing. Still, he needed recruits he could train, not deserters or unhinged killers. The line moved slowly. Hober engaged the potential recruits with questions, chatted about their pastimes and families as much as their combat experience. Hober was good at his job, good at judging who would last and who would panic and get someone killed. Namir paced and tried to stay out of the way. Intellectually, he knew what the recruits felt like. Knew they'd be more likely to come clean when relaxed. He'd been in their position less than 3 years before. But at the moment, he couldn't muster either interest or sympathy. Someone in the line shouted. Namir turned to see 3 locals grappling with one another. 2 of them were cursing and striking the third, a pale, gangly girl with a bolt of red hair. The apparent victim went down 4 times in as many seconds, popped back up after each hit, and seemed ready to keep brawling. Not a good fighter, but Namir gave her credit for persistence. He fired 3 shots above the trio. They went still. The red-haired girl couldn't have been more than a teenager, and the other 2 looked scarcely older.
"Do I need to care what's going on here?" Namir asked, then cut the air horizontally with his hand before anyone could answer. "We'll all be happier if you say no." The 3 youths shook their heads. "Fight on my ship?
and you'll be sealed in a maintenance closet until you starve to death, Namir said. I won't waste blaster bolts on you. I won't waste oxygen shooting you out an airlock. You'll die slowly because I don't care. Namir lacked both the callousness and the authority to carry out that particular threat, but the would-be recruits didn't know it. One of the older pair hesitated, then turned and stalked away. The other two lowered their eyes. How old are you? Namir asked the red-haired kid.
20,
she said, jerking her head back up. That didn't seem likely, but there was no time for background checks. Nor would she be the first 16-year-old to enlist in the Alliance. Namir turned and nodded his approval to Hober. The old quartermaster looked skeptical. Namir wondered if Hober would admit the girl into the ranks of Twilight's fresh meat, but he suspected the man would do so against his own better judgment. It wasn't about being welcoming. These days, Twilight Company couldn't afford to be choosy. 3 hours into the open recruit, word came down that Namir's squad was needed outside the governor's mansion. It was a welcome distraction. Twilight had locked down the mansion during the first day of fighting. The compound of multi-tiered domes was on the outskirts of the city, impractically far from the center of Imperial power, but possessed of an impressive view of the crystalline mountains. After the initial skirmishing, Captain Howell had ordered half a dozen rebel squads stationed around its perimeter, within a stone's throw of its scorched but intact outer wall. No attempt to capture it had been made. With its occupants contained, the mansion itself had seemed strategically insignificant. Since then, the situation had evolved.
Masteroid rolled out through a side entrance half an hour ago, Sergeant Fectron said. We figured it was rigged to blow. Turned out clean. It was carrying a written message from a rebel sympathizer inside the mansion.
Namir, Gadrin, Charmer, and Brand stood across from the mansion wall. The others rechecked their equipment as Namir and Fectron spoke. Periodically, one of the mansion's windows slid open, spat a volley of hissing red particle bolts onto the street, then shut again. Fectron's team barely seemed to notice.
What'd the message say?
Namir asked.
That Governor Chalice's men are holding captured rebel soldiers inside. Our anonymous tipster, and I quote, fears for their safety.
Namir spat onto the road and watched his saliva sizzle where the bolts had impacted. They know we've accounted for everyone, right? Do they think we're that stupid?
I told Howell the same thing, Fectron said.
More or less.
The ridges of his face crinkled in discomfort, and the tendrils dangling from his cheeks and chin seemed to curl. Namir thought of those tendrils as a sort of beard, though he'd never asked if they were present on the women of Fectron species.
But the captain's worried the governor might have grabbed some locals, once it checked out. Besides,
Fectron went on,
if it's a trap, then what's the point? We lose a squad in there. We don't exactly lose the war.
Namir stared at Fectron with as much skepticism as he could muster.
So the captain's theory, he said, is that he can afford to gamble away our lives on the off chance we'll save a few civvies.
Fectron's tendrils twitched, but Namir kept talking.
Do I have this right?
Gadrin was frowning. Fectron took it in stride. Namir had never seen Fectron smile, but the alien had a deadpan sense of humor.
You want to take it up with Howell?
Fectron asked. Namir swore and barked a bitter laugh.
Fine, he said. But if we die, we're taking the whole mansion down with us.
Charmer came up with the squad's approach. Climbing the wall or besieging the main entrance would draw too much opposition. Fectron would prep a frontal assault, but only for use as a last resort. Instead, Namir, Brand, and Charmer made their way to the rooftop garden of one of the neighboring residences. The occupants were more than cooperative after Namir burned 3 blaster holes in their custodial droid and stayed out of sight
while Charmer secured a magnetic grappling gun in one of the flower beds. Brand watched the governor's mansion through the lenses of her armored mask. On her signal, Charmer fired the gun and sent the grapnel soaring through the resurgent air. It struck the wall abutting one of the mansion's lower balconies, attached, and pulled the line taut. Namir traversed the gap first, sliding down the line and landing with a jolt on the damp stone. Charmer came next, then Brand. Brand severed the line with a curved knife that she pulled from her jacket. The blade hummed softly with electricity.
"Where'd you get that?"
Namir asked.
"Confiscated," Brand said.
Namir glanced at Charmer, who pulled a stun rod from his belt and extended the baton. It looked like it would snap in two with a bit of effort. He passed it to Namir, who shook his head until Charmer pressed the weapon into his palm.
"I have my own knife," Charmer said,
forcing the words past his stutter.
"You need a nedge."
Namir scowled but didn't argue. It was true he didn't have the taller man's reach.
"We're heading in," he said, tapping his comlink. "You hear screams, you know what to do."
Gadran's deep voice came through, mixed with static.
"I will weep at your funerals, and after grieving, I will requisition a gravel that can support my mass. Many lives will be saved in the future."
"That's the spirit," Namir said. Together, the three proceeded into the mansion. The rooms were dark and spacious in the imperial style, appointed with lush carpets and glittering holographic mobiles that rotated and pulsed with the movements of the squad. Namir led the way through connected suites and into a tall, narrow hallway carved from mountain crystal. There, bronze busts and statuettes sat in niches along the wall. Namir didn't recognize most of the subjects. The men and women in the statuettes nearly all wore imperial military uniforms or robes of state. A bust of an elderly man with cheeks like melted wax and thinning hair bore a resemblance to the Galactic Emperor. Namir had seen him before in rebel propaganda videos. A horned figure might have been the Emperor's aged vizier. Namir dredged his memory for the name. Mas Amida. Charmer and Brand seemed more familiar with the lineup. Charmer scowled at a middle-aged man whose bulbous alien eyes were set in a human face and whose neck was braced by a thick metal collar. The round collar gave the bust the appearance of a grotesque potted plant. Brand paused before the recreation of a misshapen helmet of curves and angles and skull-like eyes.
"You know him?" Namir asked.
"Not personally," Brand said.
"Darth Vader,"
Charmer said. He didn't stammer.
"The Galactic Emperor's personal enforcer. Hound of the Rebel Alliance. Born from the embers of the Clone Wars. Perpetrator of every horror and atrocity known to civilization."
So the stories went anyway.
"Right," Namir whispered. "Can we get on with it?"
To Namir's surprise, Brand looked at him and spoke in a low, somber tone.
"You should know these people," she said. "Darth Vader, General Tulia, Count Vidian. Look at their faces and memorize everyone."
Namir returned Brand's stare, cool and calm. Brand didn't back down.
"I get it," Namir said softly. "I do."
"You don't," Brand said, and began to walk again.
Charmer, three steps ahead, gestured before the stairway at the end of the hall. Two fingers raised, thumb moving across the palm. Two guards stationed at the top of the stairs, one patrolling. Brand went first. In his darker moments, Namir resented the older woman's capacity for stealth, but not today. Not when his own wet boots squeaked like rats on the polished floor. He followed her, tightening his grip on the stun baton, with Charmer so close behind he could feel the man's body heat. Up the stairs. Two guards, neither in full armor. Local security.
Bran stepped out of the mouth of the stairwell, and Namir heard sizzling as the electrified knife found its first target. Namir charged forward, body low, looking for the patrol. Charmer would know to take the second guard behind him. The sentry on patrol was less than 5 meters away, and Namir felt his guts clench when they spotted each other. An Imperial stormtrooper. The trooper was still turning to face him. Namir had time to close the distance, but the stun baton would be useless against that white armor. He should have asked to borrow Brand's knife when he'd had the chance. Namir raised his shoulder as he charged. He slammed into the stormtrooper and spun him to face the stairwell. Now at the trooper's back, Namir clung to the armor's cool surface and tried to pin the man's arms, prevent him from getting off even one shot with his blaster. That noise would alert the entire mansion, and their attempt at stealth would be compromised. The stormtrooper reacted swiftly, competently. He threw his head back, grazed Namir's scalp where Namir's abandoned helmet should have protected him. If Namir had been standing straight instead of bending his knees, he would have taken the hit between the eyes. After a moment, he smelled burning metal and plastoid, and the stormtrooper went limp as Brand twisted her knife under the rim of his helmet. Namir tried to guide the body in a slide onto the floor, but it clattered more loudly than he'd intended. Charmer stood between the two security guards, both dead on the ground. Brand had already cleaned her knife by the time Namir said, "Keep moving." The message warning Twilight about the governor's captives had included a rough map of the mansion. The hallway the team found itself in now was, at Namir's estimate, less than 50 meters from the captive's supposed location. If there was an ambush waiting, they'd be walking into it soon. Namir gave the rifle slung on his back a quick feel, confirmed he hadn't somehow lost its comforting bulk during the fight. Stealth would only take them so far, and he wanted to be ready. Charmer took the lead next. Namir didn't correct him. Somehow Charmer always wound his way to the front when an ambush seemed imminent, for reasons Namir couldn't understand and couldn't bring himself to ask about. Losing his face hadn't broken Charmer of the habit. Namir certainly wouldn't be able to. Onward down a cramped passage into a supply pantry that smelled of citrus. Namir assumed the scent was artificial until he saw that there was fruit, real fruit, casually stocked with the rest of the governor's boundless wealth. He drew one long breath of the aroma and then shook off the distraction. Past the pantry was a kitchen, sleek and metallic, and packed with long-limbed droids nestled in their power stations. Charmer paused at the narrow door leading farther into the mansion and shrugged. The map indicated the captives were in the next room. Namir glanced at Brand as she took a position across the doorframe from Charmer. "If anyone's been saving a flash bomb," Namir said, "now's the time to speak up." No one did. Fine, Namir thought. No smoke cover, no flash. We breached the old-fashioned way. It didn't bother him. The old ways were what he knew best. He clipped the stun rod to his belt, took his rifle in both hands. Charmer and Brand mirrored him. Namir nodded. Charmer hit the door's keypad, and they surged inside together. What they found was a dining hall, or what had been a dining hall, now so strewn with printouts and holo displays and maps and portable screens that it resembled the inside of a bureaucrat's skull. Standing amid the makeshift workstations were half a dozen Imperial Army officers, caps doffed, expressions haggard, sweat staining their black uniforms, who were so intent on their work that it took half a second before they looked up at Namir and his squad. Namir took aim at the first man to reach for his sidearm, a sharp-nosed colonel who'd been pacing alongside the dining table, and watched the rest of the group hesitate. Brand and Charmer swept their rifles in steady arcs while Namir kept his eye on the colonel. "Prisoners, where are they?"
"What prisoners?" the colonel asked.
Namir's muscles were taut. He kept his voice calm.
"The ones you captured. Or the ones you claimed you captured."
"I have no idea what you're talking about," the colonel said.
His right hand began to edge toward his belt. Namir cocked his head. The colonel froze again.
He really doesn't, a voice replied, warm and resonant in the dining hall.
Namir wanted to turn to look at the speaker, but taking his attention from the colonel would mean death. He kept his rifle aimed, kept his body turned toward his opponent, and trusted that brand or charmer would cover the remainder of the room. The new speaker slowly resolved in his peripheral vision. She was emerging from one of the side entrances to the hall, a human woman whose olive-skinned visage was lined just enough to add gravitas to a once youthful face. Her black hair was threaded with gray and white, and she wore a dark formal suit trimmed with red and clasped with silver buttons. In contrast with the suit's obvious expense was a worn and stained duffel bag she'd slung over one shoulder, the kind a rebel soldier or a vagabond might carry.
"I'm the captive here," she said with bored disdain.
"The fact the colonel doesn't realize it." As the woman spoke, she let the duffel bag slide from her right shoulder and land heavily on the floor. The words kept coming with that same idle tone as, while the bag fell, she drew a blaster pistol from her left pocket.
"Shows how little he pays attention."
The blaster flashed red, and Namir's target fell to the dining table, a hole burned between his shoulder blades. Namir wasn't sure who fired next. The sound of one bolt merged with another and another after that. He dropped to his knees, swung to acquire a target, saw an officer with a something, maybe a weapon, maybe a comlink, in his hand, and shot him. Flecks of stone spilled onto Namir's hair as someone blasted the wall above his head. He scrambled forward, took shelter under the table, reached up and over, and fired wildly. The dead colonel's legs obscured his view of the other side of the room. The bolt slowed. He rolled out from under the table and loosed a volley at the first black-clad form he saw. After that, only one officer was left. Namir didn't understand what the Imperial was aiming for at first. The man had backed himself into a corner and his blaster was low, pointed toward the floor. Then Namir saw the pile at the officer's feet. Charmer was kneeling on the ground, moaning in pain, both hands clasped to one of his hips. Namir began to turn his rifle on the officer, but the woman in the suit killed him first, with a snarl and a flick of the blaster in her hand. Namir ignored her and hurried to Charmer's side. Gently, he peeled back Charmer's hands and examined his right hip. The material of his pants was scorched through, the fibers melted into blackened skin. The injury wasn't fatal, but it had to hurt, and Charmer wouldn't be walking out of there. Namir bared his teeth in what he hoped was a smirk. "Quit moaning," he said. "It's already cauterized. You want it to bandage itself too?" Charmer laughed hoarsely and croaked an obscenity. Brand methodically secured each door to the dining hall as Namir stood and looked to the woman who'd claimed to be the captive. She was standing at the dining table, pouring a pitcher of water over her hands as if to clean them, not of blood, as Namir thought at first, but of caked on dirt like clay. Her weapon sat beside the pitcher. "Who are you?" he asked. The woman barely glanced toward Namir as she wiped her hands dry on her hips.
"My name is Ivari Chalas," she said. "Governor of Hadoral Prime. Emissary to the Imperial Ruling Council. And of course..."
Here her lip curled up as if at a private joke. "Local artist in residence." She began walking among the bodies, nudging each with the toe of her boot as if to confirm that it was dead.
"Declaring myself a captive may have been an exaggeration, but I needed your attention."
When she came to the colonel, still sprawled across the table, she leaned in close, hoisted him by his hair, and spat between his unseeing eyes. "Glad you're so loyal to your staff," Namir said, slow and cautious. When Chalas turned around, he had his rifle aimed at her chest. She didn't seem bothered.
"They weren't mine," she said sourly. "My staff, my advisors, my bodyguards, my chef, were taken away months ago. These men were here to police me, at the behest of the Emperor.
Charmer was trying to stammer something. Namir only heard the word, chef. Brand glanced from a side door to Namir, and then to the governor.
Shoot her, she said. Hedoro deserves that much.
Namir scowled. The pieces weren't coming together, and he suddenly felt the weight of days without sleep, the 30 hours of fighting.
Why did you need our attention?
He asked.
Thanks to the rebellion, my days with the Empire are numbered.
The governor smiled, but her tone was acid.
I understand your recruiting. I want to join your company in return for asylum.
Namir took aim with his rifle. He wondered how many more guards were in the mansion and how long he had before they showed. He tried to guess how much Charmer's injury would slow down the squad's exit. He didn't have time to parse the lies at play. Then came a low electric warbling and an oscillating flash of blue light. The governor's lips parted, but she said nothing. Her limbs stiffened, and she fell to the floor beside her bag. Namir swung about. Standing in the last of the unsecured doorways was Gadrin, two arms clasping his weapon and aiming the barrel toward where the governor had stood. He was breathing hard, enormous shoulders rising and falling.
We lost contact. I thought there was trouble. I am pleased to see I overreacted.
Brand eyed the fallen governor. She's still breathing, she said.
Why a stun shot?
Gadrin crept to Charmer's side, pausing to assess the scarred man's injuries before gently lifting him from the floor and cradling him in two arms. Not until Charmer was secure did Gadrin say,
I feared for the captives. A blaster bolt could have killed one.
No captives, Brand said.
Gadrin nodded, not in comprehension, but in recognition that now was not the time for questions. Namir stalked to the governor and checked the body. She was breathing steadily. No spasms, no choking, no irregular heartbeat. Stun bolts weren't reliable, but this one seemed to have done its job, which meant the governor was still Namir's problem.
We'll pack her up, take her to Howl. He nodded toward Gadrin. If you've got room for one more.
No need to be gentle. Gadrin roughly grabbed the governor by her collar and threw her over a shoulder, using one hand to keep the body in place. Namir wondered if Brand would argue, but she was lifting the governor's bag as she said,
They say kidnapping an Imperial is bad luck.
Namir couldn't tell if she was joking.
Bad men crave bad luck, he replied.
It was a saying he'd learned long ago on a more primitive world.
Now can we get off this planet?
He was ready to be done with the rain. He was ready to sleep. He was ready to forget the piles of dead civilians and the opulent mansion filled with aromatic fruit and busts of murderers. The attack on Hedoro Prime hadn't been a failure, but it had been laden with troubles. Now, he was taking one of those troubles home.
Chapter 3 Planet Salast, Day 85 of the Midrim Retreat.
As evening approached in Pinyumba, the obsidian of the cavern roof slowly lost its refracted iridescence. The great towers of the city, rising from the cave floor like stalagmites, dimmed their upper lights until the dome was lost to blackness. The yellow sulfur that clung to the cavern walls seemed to turn sickly pale. The rustling of ash angel wings came and went as the creatures returned from foraging to nest. With the ash angels came the people of Pinyumba, arriving in lifts and shuttles from the factories of the surface or departing their housing blocks for the night shifts. There were dark and pale humans, gray-skinned Salastans, and rarer species too. Pinyumba was cosmopolitan in its way. Those willing to toil were welcome, and all others were outcasts. Thara Nayendi didn't linger in the streets or stroll along the turquoise streams that flowed by Pinyumba's walkways. She didn't stop to pick out familiar faces from the commuter crowds. Like everyone else, she had errands to run before curfew. She did, however, take the time to nod firmly in the direction of the stormtroopers posted at every shuttle and intersection. Only twice did the men or women inside the armor nod back. Thara passed squat steel-gray buildings that bore no signs, but that she knew well, a public bathhouse, a hospice, a cafe, and then descended a short flight of steps hewn from the cavern rock to an unmarked door. She hoisted the leather bag slung over her shoulder and pushed inside, where her eyes slowly adjusted to the dim cantina lighting. No more than a dozen customers were present, nearly all men and nearly all old, no matter the species. They were broad-shouldered and wrinkled, sturdy and scarred from years of work in the Inyusu Tor mineral processing facility. Most were gathered about a hollow table displaying an off-world sporting event, but they spoke to one another loud enough to drown out the soft holocast.
"Uncle!" Thara called in the direction of the bar. "I'm here to spoil you."
The man who looked up from the array of nozzles behind the bar and started Thara's way looked old enough to be her grandfather rather than her uncle. And if his hair had ever matched her bright blonde locks, the color had faded long ago. He clapped her on the shoulders as other heads turned and aged lips smiled at the young woman. The voices around the hollow table lowered.
"The only person getting spoiled is you,"
Thara's uncle said before accepting the leather bag from her hands.
"Working half as long as the rest of us and paid twice as much. But let's see what you've got anyway."
He placed the bag on an empty table and began to rummage through its contents. First out was a tube of ochre gel. Thara's uncle turned it in his hands, then shouted over his shoulder,
"Mayan! Got another tube of burn salve! Boys in Dorm 4 still hurting?"
Thara remembered the accident with the Dorm 4 workers. They'd been scalded badly when the steam pipes from the magna extractors had broken. Some of the workers still hadn't returned to duty. Soon they'd be evicted from their residence. Mayan, a diminutive Celestin, hobbled over to the table. He spoke in his native tongue, too quickly for Thara to fully understand, but the tone sounded grateful, and carried the salve away.
"Good start,"
Thara's uncle said. Thara smiled at him wryly and nearly caught him smiling back. One by one, he pulled Thara's donations from the bag. Extra food credits, flu tablets, mask filters for the men working in the deepest ore processors. And, calling his customers to the table, meted out gift after gift. Some of the recipients clasped Thara's hands, praised her and her family. Others refused to look at her. As her uncle continued sorting through the bag, she drifted away and studied the nozzles on the wall behind the bar. Her uncle had been repairing them, she saw now, replacing a fluid valve. He'd left his tools on the floor. She picked them up and started working, the way she remembered doing as a teenager.
"My son gave me a flyer the other day. Says he's thinking about joining."
Thara was close enough to the hollow table now that she could hear the older workers' hushed voices. She didn't want to hear. She hadn't intended to eavesdrop. But she wasn't going to leave either.
"After the accident with the magma release, he said maybe the Cobalt Front was right. Maybe we do need to stand up for ourselves."
"The Cobalt Laborers' Reformation Front?"
a second voice sneered.
"Is a band of terrorists. They probably caused the accident in the first place."
There was murmuring, reluctant agreement.
"Protests are one thing. Riots are another."
Thara screwed the new valve into place. Cobalt Front members were terrorists, according to Imperial decree. It was a pity. She thought they might have done some good if they'd stuck to talking about safety procedures and factory conditions.
"Is it our fault?"
the first voice asked.
"I know I protected mine. I didn't tell my son what we saw in the Clone Wars."
the third voice laughed.
"Of course you didn't. Your kids would have never slept."
The first man continued,
But they would have known. They'd see why even a hard piece is better than the alternative.
Just pray the Rebel Alliance never notices Sullust. You think things are rough now?
Thara tested the attached nozzle, caught a trickle of something green and sweet-smelling in her palm.
Nah!
A new voice said in slow, ragged Sullustan, deliberately loud. Thara recognized the rasp of toxin-afflicted lungs. The condition was becoming increasingly common among the workers. Someone tried to shush the new speaker as Thara rose from behind the bar. The toxin-afflicted man, a withered Sullustan with drooping ears and jowls, kept going.
This is not peace. We are all slaves, every one of us. And the Emperor forges stronger chains every year.
Thara's uncle was hurrying to the hollow table. He squeezed the withered man's arm as the Sullustan propped himself against the tabletop and continued to speak.
I don't care who hears me,
the withered man snapped.
What Nunbar said was true. We traded our lives to buy 1,000 years of darkness. The Empire runs on the blood of our grandchildren.
Thara's uncle forced the man back into his seat. Thara looked around the table. The workers were all staring at her, silent.
I'll be back next week, she said quietly. If you need something, tell my uncle. I'll try to help.
No one spoke as she left the cantina. She walked briskly down the street as if she could pound her frustrations into the stone, sweat them out through the soles of her feet. She tried to put what she'd heard out of her mind, concentrate on the evening ahead. She was nearly late for her shift as it was. She couldn't afford to go on duty distracted. She marched to the door of a sleek industrial building, looked into the mechanical eye of the scanner so that it could identify her. Passed 2 more checkpoints and onto her locker, where she finally began to relax. Donning her uniform always calmed her. She'd learned to dress and attach its components in less than a minute, but she preferred to go slowly, first stripping down and removing one by one the garments of Thara Nyendi of Sullust and stowing them in the locker. Next, she pulled on her new skin, a tough black body glove that sealed itself as she climbed in, too hot to be comfortable until the smart material adjusted to her body heat and the temperature of the room. She slid her feet into her white synth leather boots and then, always left first, then right, snapped her plastoid greaves onto her legs. The soft click and hum of mechanisms assured her she'd attached the pieces correctly, and their perfect sculpt felt far more natural than anything she could buy as a civilian. Belt and crotch plate came next, then the torso piece, locked into the belt, finally making her feel clothed. Shoulders, arms, and gloves came after the torso. Most days, she'd already forgotten her ordinary troubles by this point. Sometimes she noticed her breathing had steadied, her muscle tension drained into the support of the bodysuit and plastoid. She could have attached the arm sections faster with the help of a droid or a colleague, but this was her ritual. She liked doing it alone. Finally, the helmet. She took it from its place in the locker and lowered it onto her head. For an instant, she was in total darkness. Then it clicked into place, the lenses polarized, and the heads-up display blinked to life. Targeting diagnostics cycled over her view of the locker room, power levels and environmental readings blinking at the corners of her eyesight. Like that, Thara Nyendi faded into the background. A stronger woman, a better woman, stepped into place to do her duty. She was SP-475 of the Imperial 97th Stormtrooper Legion.
Chapter 4 Kontar Sector,
Day 85 of the Midrim Retreat.
You have no idea how the Empire really works. The Rebel Alliance military transport Thunderstrike was not designed for comfort. Its corridors were lined with pipes and panels, and its doors were bulky and cumbersome, plated with heavy Durasteel. Over the years, Twilight Company had stripped down and reconfigured the aging Corellian Corvette, partitioning and repartitioning the ship's few open spaces until barely a square meter was left unused. Thus, when Hal ordered the prisoner brought to his storage unit-turned office for questioning, the meeting was an intimate one. On one side of Hal's flimsy folding desk sat the captain himself, flanked by Lieutenant Sargon and Chief Medic Von Geis. While Sargon stood stiff as ever, like an ancient and gnarled tree, Von Geis had propped himself atop an offline holoprojector. Facing Howl and leaning back in her chair, with exaggerated ease, was Governor Chalice, smiling like an empress. Behind Chalice stood Namir, who watched the governor's hands as if she might be about to reach across the desk and strangle the captain. "I'm not saying that to be insulting," Chalice went on. "But if you think Hadoral Prime was anything more than a backwater, you're operating under dearly mistaken assumptions. My appointment there was a punishment, not an elevation." She spoke in a low voice, full of bored confidence. In the safety of the ship, her Coruscanti accent, the accent of the Imperial elite, a propaganda broadcast and rebel satire, seemed overly enunciated to Namir's ears.
"And why did you deserve punishment?" the captain asked. Chalice cocked her head as if surprised by the question.
"When your rebellion started encroaching on the Midrim, the Emperor set his dog loose. You heard about the deaths of Moff Coovern and Minister Kempt?"
"Tragic accidents, as I recall," Hal said.
"According to my sources, both died at the hand of Darth Vader. Emperor Palpatine decided that incompetence at the highest ranks was to blame for the destruction of his Death Star, and from there began a culling. There were other deaths, less public," she added with a shrug. "I was spared out of acknowledgement for my past contributions, and because I had enough sense to limit my involvement with the battle station. Exile to Hadoral Prime was the best I could hope for, under the circumstances." Von Geis peered at Chalice as if inspecting the skin of her forehead.
"And that's when you chose to defect?" he asked.
Namir suspected Von Geis was present to put a kind face on the company. He'd begun the meeting by checking Chalice over, asking about after effects of the stun bolt, while Howl had waited patiently and Lieutenant Sargon had scowled. Von Geis was a smart man, and he knew the role he'd been asked to play. Kind, fatherly, sympathetic. But Chalice barely looked at anyone but the captain. "Don't be absurd," Chalice said. "Even on Hadoral I had time to read, time to sculpt. I had money for occasional luxuries." She turned in her chair and reached down to where Namir had placed her duffel bag. He'd already inspected it for weapons, though he'd only delivered it to the office under protest. Unlike Von Geis, Namir wasn't in the room to ask questions or manipulate the governor. Hal hadn't said as much, of course, but Namir knew he was present as muscle. Chalice's capture was being kept a secret. As first sergeant, Namir was a high-ranking grunt, authorized to witness senior staff discussions and duty-bound not to do a thing about them.
"And speaking of luxuries," Chalice said, "you've been more than hospitable, and I've been ungracious."
From the bag she retrieved a glass bottle filled with a translucent violet liquid adrift with gossamer white threads. She turned it in her hands, set it on the desk with a heavy thunk, then withdrew a handful of yellow fruit, which she placed beside the bottle. "A gift from Hadoral to my hosts. Local brandy and native figs. Something to celebrate our
new relationship.